I think we can get started now if folks can find a seat. I can usually say there are a bunch of them up front, but there really aren't. So there are one or two, and the folks are trying to direct you to where they are. I want to welcome you. My name is Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Rockefeller, Senator Collins, our board of directors, welcome to this program on how you look from a healthcare perspective at how states are coping with the lingering effects of the recession. That is to say, declining revenues, growing needs for health coverage among lower income populations, and of course, everywhere but Vermont, a balanced budget requirement in your constitutions. You could call it a perfect storm, but around here we don't like to talk about storms these days. We've had quite enough. Now, we know that individuals and families are hurting as a result of the recession, and often, a lot of that hurt comes from the loss of their job and therefore of their health coverage. Many of these folks turn to state-run insurance programs for their health care needs, and find that states are grappling with this multi-front battle of fitting enlarged needs into shrinking revenue pots. And today, we're going to look at just how states, and in a couple of states in particular, are dealing with this dilemma. Now, there may or may not be a major health reform bill this year. There's a lot of talk about gridlock in D.C. these days. It is useful to note, I think, that Congress did act in 2009 to pump billions of dollars into state Medicaid programs, and they passed an extension of the CHIP program that both extended and expanded that popular activity. And today we hope to not only get a grasp of what's happening now, but also to look ahead, peer around the corner, and see how states hope to deal with what's just over the horizon. My colleague and co-moderator, Diane Rowland, is Executive Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation, Executive Director of its Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, which is technically our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing. She also happens to know about as much as anybody about health care for vulnerable populations. So we're very pleased to have you with us, Diane, and let me turn to you.
Well, thank you, Ed, and thank you all for being here. It's really important, I think, amid all of the hype this week about the summit on Thursday on health reform, to remember that there are states out there struggling and people out there struggling to get health insurance coverage now, and that health reform for all of us seems a long way away, even if it happens when we're in the middle of still the throes of such a deep recession. And one of the roles that the commission and the work of the foundation has tried to focus us on is what's going on today in the states, what's happening with health care coverage, what's happening to the vulnerable populations there. If states are to be the building block with Medicaid for coverage of the low-income population under health care reform, how do we keep this program going and from eroding before we get to where health reform kicks in? So I think all of those topics are going to be ones that you'll hear about today. I think one of the issues that I'm sure was on the minds of all the governors and that was included in the president's budget but is yet to be enacted by Congress is whether the stimulus funding, the FMAP increase, will be continued into 2011 to help states weather more of the storm. So I think today we're going to hear about what's going on with state budgets generally, with two states specifically, and I hope it'll help give us some better guidance of what we do between now and health care reform, even if after Thursday we magically have health care reform on Friday.
Remember, you heard it here first. Thanks, Diane. A couple of logistical items. You have background information, including biographical information on our speakers, in your packets. We won't do them justice up here. Probably tomorrow, there'll be a webcast and podcast available of this briefing on KFF.org, thanks to our friends at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And in a few days, on the Alliance website, that is to say allhealth.org, you can view a transcript of today's discussion, along with, on both websites, copies of materials that are in your packets. And would ask you at the appropriate time to fill out the green question cards, if that's how you would like to get your question before the panel. And before you leave, fill out the blue evaluation form so that we can improve these briefings for your use. Now let's get to the program we have. As Diane alluded to, a very knowledgeable group of panelists today with a broad range of experiences, and we'll hear from them briefly, and then we'll have a lot of time for discussion and questions. Leading off today is Robin Rudowitz, who's a principal policy analyst for the Kaiser Commission. She's responsible for much of the Commission's Medicaid financing work, for developing research, producing Commission publications. In previous lives, she's been a senior manager at the Lewin Group, and while she was at CMS, she worked directing their Medicaid part of the Office of Legislation for a couple of years. So we have a very knowledgeable and well-informed beginning to our discussion. Robin, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Ed and Diane. Also, thanks, everyone, for coming today to this very important and timely session. As Diane mentioned, there's health reform on the table. There are also governors developing their budgets for state fiscal year 2011, and Congress is also debating about the extension of the enhanced Medicaid funds included in the stimulus bill. I also want to thank also the Medicaid directors who continually provide us the information that we use to produce our reports, our colleagues at HMA, Health Management Associates, for helping us to work on our reports, David Rousseau and Tanya Schwartz from the Commission for working on the Medicaid enrollment report as well, that was done very quickly to get it out in advance of this meeting. So I'm going to just provide a quick setup of some of the key issues and context, and then we'll, of course, turn it over and hear from the states and what's happening on the ground. Okay. Before we get started, I just wanted to provide a real brief reminder about the really diverse roles that Medicaid provides or plays in today's healthcare system. Of course, we all know it provides coverage for low-income families as well as many elderly and people with disabilities. Medicaid also provides assistance to low-income Medicare beneficiaries. The program really serves as the primary payer and provider of long-term care services. Medicaid represents a major player in today's healthcare system in terms of contribution to overall healthcare spending, and it's particularly important for safety net providers as a source of revenue. And, of course, we also know that Medicaid and the federal dollars from Medicaid help states to finance health coverage. So it's all of these roles that make Medicaid important in the healthcare system, and these roles are also much more important as we're in an economic downturn and recession. We know now that in January of 2010, the national unemployment rate stood at 9.7%, and there are about 15 million people unemployed. Many people who are working would also prefer to be working full-time and have settled for part-time work. Since the start of the recession in December 2007, over 8 million people have lost their jobs. Strikingly, when we look at changes just from last year, from December 2008 to December 2009, we see a real dramatic shift in how states are experiencing their unemployment rates. In December of 2008, there was only one state, Michigan, that had unemployment rate in excess of 10%. And we now see that 17 states have unemployment rates above 10%. So that's a big shift there. We also see that many states are, of course, facing huge budget gaps, mostly as a result of historic declines in state tax revenue. When we look at the first three quarters of what happened in 2009, we see double-digit declines in state tax revenue across the board. And we know from other data, when we look at what's been happening with state budget gaps for 2010 and into 2011, budget shortfalls could total in excess of $350 billion. We know that as unemployment rises, we see increases in Medicaid and CHIP enrollment, and we also see increases in the number of people who are uninsured. As people lose their employer or job-based coverage, more people and incomes fall, demand for public programs increases, and of course this happens right at the time that states can least afford to pay for it. Working with the Urban Institute, there's a rule that for every 1 percentage point increase in the national unemployment rate, we're likely to see a 1 million increase in enrollment in Medicaid and CHIP, and also a 1.1 million increase in the number of people without insurance. Last year, in February 2009, the Congress acted and the President signed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that included a temporary increase in the federal share of Medicaid spending. It was worth an estimated $87 billion in federal funds, and the relief was to help states from October 2008, and it's scheduled right now to expire at the end of 2010. All states saw an increase in the federal share, or what the federal share would be for their Medicaid program. States got at least a 6.2 percentage point increase in their Medicaid match rate. And then states who were experiencing very high rates of unemployment got some additional help. And states still need to pay their own share of their Medicaid financing, but again, just the federal share was increased from what used to be 50 to 76%. Now the federal share ranges from 61 to 84%. The condition for receiving these additional federal funds was that states could not restrict their eligibility levels, and they also could not make it more difficult for people to enroll in the program. We know that to date about $44 billion in the enhanced FMAP have been outlaid by the federal government, and the money did get to the states quickly, so states were able to use it quickly. And states really reported multiple uses for the funds. They were able to close budget shortfalls in their Medicaid programs, mitigate or avoid some of the cuts that they otherwise would have had to make to providers or to benefits. And the funds also helped to support these increases in their enrollment. And also preserve eligibility. We often tend to focus on Medicaid as a coverage program, which of course it is, but research also shows that state spending on Medicaid also yields very positive results in state economies, generating revenue and jobs in state economies. And these results and effects are really magnified exponentially by the influx of federal matching funds. On the flip side, we know that cuts to state Medicaid programs can slow the pace of economic recovery because, again, states are sacrificing additional federal matching funds. We know that when a state wants to save at least a dollar or a dollar of state funds, they need to cut over $2 of program spending to make that happen. When we look at the results from 2009 related to spending and enrollment growth in the Medicaid program, there were really some dramatic results. When states had adopted their budgets for 2009 state fiscal year, states had anticipated 5.8% spending growth and only 3.6% enrollment growth. We know from the data that we just released that enrollment growth from June 2008 to June 2009 was actually 7.5%. And we know that meant that 3.3 million more people were added to the rolls of the Medicaid program. This was the largest increase in absolute numbers on record. And we also know that every state experienced an increase in enrollment in their Medicaid budgets, or their Medicaid enrollment. Looking forward to 2010, when states adopted their budgets over the summer, they were only anticipating 6.3% spending growth and 6.6% enrollment growth. But when we talked to the Medicaid directors in November, so at the end of 2009, we know that 44 states were really anticipating that these growth rates were too low. So we're anticipating that they'll be much higher when we look at the final results. Despite the ARRA funds, which definitely helped the states, we saw that many states, when they even adopted their budgets for 2010, were implementing more policy restrictions than they had in prior years, particularly related to provider rate cuts and to benefit cuts. We do know, again, that the ARRA requirements for maintaining eligibility made it so that no states really cut back on their eligibility levels. Of course, facing mid-year budget shortfalls for their 2010 budgets, we also know that 29 states say that they're thinking about, many have enacted additional cuts, or they're likely to enact additional budget cuts on top of the ones that they already had planned on implementing for 2010. So, with a bit of a grim picture, looking forward, we know that even when the economy does start to recover, we know that the budget pressures for states as well as for individuals will persist for some time. And we also anticipate that enrollment growth in the Medicaid program will remain strong. We know that states are really struggling to maintain their current programs, but cuts to providers and to benefits are on the table as states really have to meet mid-year budget shortfalls for 2010. When we look forward to 2011, most states are quite concerned about the expiration of the enhanced matching funds through ARRA, and that December 2010 expiration hits right in the middle of state fiscal year 2011, so states are now needing to think about what they'll do about that large cliff in financing, and they're anticipating many cuts to providers' benefits as well as to eligibility because the maintenance of effort and eligibility requirements would no longer be in place. And again, with all these cuts to the Medicaid program, you know, we need to worry that this could jeopardize its very important role in serving low-income populations and providing very needed health care as more individuals turn to the program for support. So with that, I will turn it over to Tom.
Very good. That's right. Next, we will hear from Tom Betlach, who directs Arizona's healthcare cost containment systems, commonly called ACCESS. That puts him in charge of overseeing health coverage for, 1.3 million people in Arizona at an annual cost of more than $9 billion. Even in D.C., that's a lot of money. He oversees providers and plans to assure the quality and cost containment and fiscal accountability for those folks and that money. He's been also the deputy at the ACCESS program and budget director for the whole state for several years. So we're pleased to have you with us, Tom. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Being a recovering budget director, I thought I would start with some numbers to help paint the grim picture that exists in Arizona. So you see some numbers up on the slide. Number one, 276,500. I won't read them all, 50 million or 50,000, 80 million. But these are the answers to some of those numbers on that slide. So Arizona is number one in the United States in terms of the percent of employment lost during this last recession. 276,000 jobs have been lost during the last recession in the state of Arizona, and we have not hit bottom yet. We've got 50,000 surplus homes, so if you all are tired of the winter months here in Washington, D.C., now is a good time to look at spending some of your winter months in Arizona. We've got 80 million square feet of surplus commercial space, so if you have a business and you're looking for a place. 48% of mortgages in the state of Arizona are underwater. 35% decrease in the general fund revenues since the start of the recession. 210,000 new members in the ACCESS program. Just last year, just in 12 months. So we were adding almost 20,000 new individuals to the program each month, which in a state like Arizona is a small city you're adding each month to the program. And the one bit of good news, it was 72 degrees outside while I was writing this presentation. Well, you all were getting about 3 feet of snow. So in terms of the ACCESS program, these are the eligibility levels. The blue denotes Medicaid. The red is our Kids Care or CHIP program, and you see that covers up to 200% for kids. We used to cover parents up to 200% as well, but we had to eliminate that program back in October. About 9,000 parents lost their coverage as a result of that. Arizona is one of five other states that covers childless adults up to 100% through a waiver. As you all know, and when you're talking about Medicaid, a lot of times we get policymakers come up to us and say, you have such a large program, so many people. What is the math in terms of looking at potential budget changes? Well, it's pretty simple in terms of the math. There's three areas that you can look at in terms of budget changes and budget reductions. You've got eligibility or enrollment. Who do you make eligible for the program? And as was mentioned, ARRA and the stimulus dollars required the maintenance of effort for states so that we could not change the Medicaid eligibility for Medicaid. Rates, what do you pay providers? And when we look at the reductions that we've done in Arizona so far, the bulk of the reductions that have been imposed on the system has been through rate reductions or not providing statutory increases for hospitals. Finally, benefits. looking at making benefit changes to the program. We sat down with the chief medical officers from a number of different health plans this last year and itemized out about $30 million in potential benefit changes, looking at podiatry and some other things. We had a public hearing. We had 400 people show up. We talked about the legislation that was involved. And at the end of the day, the legislature was not willing to make any changes with regards to the benefits on the program. And in fact, this year, just to give you a little taste, we've got 6 bills introduced to increase benefits. At the same point in time, we've got a $3 billion budget deficit. The budget changes to date in Arizona, our program today is about $743 million less than what it would have been had certain policy decisions not been made with regards to funding. Rates have had the most significant impact at over $600 million in terms of reductions to providers, 5 to 10%. Hospitals have received rate freezes for the last 2 years, and we've reduced the compensation that we pay to the health plans by $130 million. One example just that we had to do in the last few weeks was we eliminated funding for graduate medical education and disproportionate share hospital payments. Now, what we've told the hospitals and providers, we recognize that that is not good public policy. We recognize that those residency programs are critical to providing our physician pipeline, and we have a physician shortfall in the state of Arizona. But when it comes to the resources that we have, we just do not have the state match available. We're facing a shortfall in the current year of over $70 million. Eligibility, we have now capped and frozen our kids care program, our CHIP program, so there are no new eligible kids coming onto the program. We've got an 8,000 kid waiting list that was established in the first month and a half. We've increased some cost sharing, and we've had administrative reductions. So I have a staff today that's 350 people less with a program that's grown by over 300,000 since the start of the recession. The problem that we face in Arizona, there are three interconnected problems. We've got a current year deficit of $1.4 billion. We've got a structural deficit that, as you see, plays out at over $3 billion per year. And we've got cash flow problems. We've got $1 billion in terms of cash flow issues. We had to establish a line of credit for the first time in the history of the state with Bank of America. And we recently just sold our Capitol and many other buildings for $735 million just to get the cash to pay February's bills. And we'll be paying debt service on that over the next 20 years. How did we get here? The economy has obviously had a significant impact in the state of Arizona, impacted our revenues. We've added spending over the last several years as a result of countercyclical programs like Access. State actions, our legislature to date has largely taken one-time actions rather than making permanent either revenue increases or expenditure reductions. We've had constraints imposed by the voters. In Arizona, we've had a number of initiatives, and they've said, we want to expand access up to 100%, and the legislature is not able to change that. They've established the minimum requirements with regards to K-12 funding, and the legislature can't change that. And then finally, the federal government, while providing the stimulus dollars has been very helpful, the bulk of the budget is now basically off limits, not only with regards to Medicaid, but also education. This slide is probably one of the most poignant slides in terms of describing the depths of the recession in Arizona. The three lines that are towards the top show the three previous recessions, the loss of employment from the start of the recession in terms of a percentage, and then the number of months it takes to get back to the level of employment that you had at the start of the recession. So you'll see that the previous three recessions in Arizona, pretty shallow. We were back to full employment in all cases within 2 years. Compare that to the previous recession where it doesn't even look like we've hit bottom yet. It's well over 10% in terms of our employment loss, and it will take years for the state of Arizona to get back to the level of employment it was at back in 2007. This slide denotes what the budget looks like, and it shows the revenues and how they've decreased 35% since 2007. You see them dropping back to about a little over $6 billion in our 2004 levels. Meantime, you see the expenditure requirements for the general fund have stayed up around $10 billion. The two different blue lines denote the impact of the stimulus funds. So the general fund has truly dropped down, but we've been able to support many of our programs through the stimulus dollars. So that gap is the stimulus dollars that we've had available to us as a state over the last couple of years, and then you see them running out after fiscal year 2011. Many policymakers, or some policymakers in the state of Arizona, when they look at the budget and the challenges that face them, say, well, why don't we just go back to fiscal year 2004 spending levels if that's where our revenue is at? This gives you just an indication of some of the growth that we've seen in various programs that depend upon the state's general fund for its support. We've added 120,000 kids to our K-12 system at a cost of $1 billion. We've added 18,000 students to the higher education system at a cost of $400 million. We've added 10,000 prisoners to the cost of the Department of Corrections at about $400 million. And we've added 475,000 individuals to Medicaid at a cost of $1.5 billion. So just the simple math of looking at those key programs and the enrollment growth and population growth of those various programs, you come to recognize that you can't balance the budget solely through cuts. So the governor faced a daunting challenge in terms of what to do about the current year budget shortfall. She had identified $1.2 billion in budget reductions and about $1 billion in revenue increases, which is one of the most significant revenue increases in the state of Arizona ever. And the legislature recently voted to put that on the ballot, so it'll be up to the electorate in May to determine whether or not we will be increasing the sales tax in the state of Arizona to generate $1 billion to help go towards solving our budget problem. What does it specifically mean with regards to the Arizona Medicaid program? The governor's budget funds $389 million in caseload growth and $200 million to backfill the stimulus. To put this in perspective, that's almost two-thirds of the overall sales tax increase that will be on the ballot in May. So you've got Medicaid squeezing potentially other priorities that exist within state government. We've got the CHIP elimination, which is the elimination of our kids' care program, which would be the loss of coverage for 46,000 kids. The executive budget also would eliminate coverage for 310,000 individuals that are covered through the state's 1115 waiver. A large portion of them are childless adults. That will require a vote of the people and would ultimately result in about $3 billion in health care spending coming out of the system in the state of Arizona, which obviously would have a tremendous negative impact on that health care infrastructure and other employers. There's other changes with regards to provider rate reductions, benefit changes, and the continued loss of disproportionate share funding and graduate medical education. Finally, there's some important federal policy issues that you all are dealing with here in Washington, D.C. The first is health care reform and ultimately what happens there. In a state like Arizona, the Senate bill adds a cost of $4 billion between 2014 and 2020 to a program that we obviously can't support at this current time. So what to do about the maintenance of effort requirements? How do we even get to the point of expansion? But then the policy that exists in the Senate bill in terms of punishing a state like Arizona that's already gone above and beyond the Medicaid minimum requirements by covering childless adults and looking at a population that we're having a very difficult time affording. So there's some serious questions with regards to the equity and the fact that Arizona taxpayers have to pay twice, not only in Arizona, but also for other states expanding. And then finally, the importance of continuing the stimulus dollars and extending that another 6 months as part of the budget that our legislature is looking at and debating right now. And that would generate about $500 million that could obviously go a long way towards dealing with some of those potential reductions we're looking at in our state. Whew. There.
Nicely done.
Just a little bit past that 10-minute.
Well, we've had an across-the-board cut. Next time you'll have only 8.5 minutes. Next we turn to Jason Helgerson, who's head of Wisconsin's Division of Healthcare Access and Accountability in their Department of Health Services. And among his duties is overseeing Badger Care Plus, which is the merger of Family Medicaid and CHIP and Healthy Start and some other elements, all with the stated goal of getting access to affordable health insurance to 98% of the state's population. Now, before he was responsible for spending so much of Wisconsin's money, he helped manage its collection as a senior official at the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. I'm picking up a pattern here. You need to go back and forth on the financing side, I guess. But, Jason, thanks for being with us, and we're anxious to hear about what's going on in Wisconsin.
Great. Thank you, Ed. It is a pleasure to be here today. And I have an opportunity, hopefully the Arizona story is very challenging, and I appreciate Tom's thing. I might be a little more optimistic about how we feel in Wisconsin. It's always interesting to hear the stories from other states and the challenges that they face. While the recession has been challenging, and it continues to be challenging in Wisconsin, it really has not, in essence, stopped us and stopped the efforts of Governor Jim Doyle to achieve a goal he set out more than 3 years ago, which was to ensure that 98% of Wisconsin residents had access to health care. It has forced us to modify our approach somewhat and try to get a little more creative, but we're still on path to achieve that goal. So what has been our vision for comprehensive health care reform in Wisconsin? First off, a lot of what we've been trying to do is increase access. The moral argument for why Americans or Wisconsinites need access to health care to us is extremely compelling. The governor has met plenty of people during his now 7 years as governor who have told him many a story about the challenges of what it means to go without health care. We recently met an individual up in the far northern part of Wisconsin who 5 years ago had a heart attack, has not seen a doctor since, has foregone what would be basically life-maintaining medications, and all because when they had the heart attack and ended up in the hospital, they incurred so much medical debt that they've been paying off for all these years that they were very fearful of what it would mean to go back and see another doctor. That person is now enrolled in one of our programs and now is actually able to see a doctor for the first time. There are thousands and thousands of people across Wisconsin and across the country who have stories similar to that. And what we're trying very hard to do in Wisconsin, living within our difficult budgetary means, is to try to make it possible for all those people to see a doctor. In particular, we've been very focused on kids expansion. We feel like we've made great strides there. And not only just expanding access to health care coverage, but also making sure that children actually have access to high-quality services. And we also feel like in the last 3.5 years, we've made a lot of progress there. The governor firmly believes that while the state must lead in this effort, he also believes that this needs to be a partnership. And a big part of what we've been trying to do is to bring together diverse stakeholders from across the healthcare sector to the table to work with us on cost-effective strategies, trying to live within our means, but trying to help as many people as possible. And I think that's been a definite part of our strategy. And finally, and we think we're a leader in the country in this regard, is try to keep things simple. Sometimes when public policies are implemented, we do not take into account what it means for a real family on the ground trying to sign up and try to navigate through these programs. And we've had a number of examples of programs in Wisconsin that have been very successful, very popular, because they have, in fact, tried to stay true to the idea of being simple. In terms of challenges, like all states, access, although we have the second lowest uninsured rate in America, and we're very proud of that, still thousands of people in Wisconsin not accessing health insurance or not accessing the health care services that they need. So we've obviously been focused on that. Also, costs. And I think this is a fundamental thing that we're very interested in seeing more out of Washington on, is to try to control healthcare costs and coming up with creative ideas. Healthcare costs continue to grow in Wisconsin, much like they are across the country. Third, quality. A lot of us have been focused and thinking not only about making sure that people get a card, shiny new card that can access services, but also that the services that they're getting are in fact high quality and are meeting their needs. And then finally, Medicaid financial stability. What we've been trying to do, and we've done a number of things in Wisconsin, to try to ensure that as we build off the Medicaid platform, and we firmly do believe that is one of the more cost-effective ways to increase access, that we make sure that the program remains fiscally stable. And so along those lines, I'll talk a little bit today about some of our strategies in that regard. So healthcare reform in Wisconsin has really been a multi-phased approach. The governor firmly believes that he's been involved in elected office for 30 years in Wisconsin, and he has watched and seen debated health care reform for many, many years. Bills being proposed to try to put together comprehensive reform packages. They get introduced with much fanfare but rarely ever make any progress. And he decided that during his time in office, he really wanted to see tangible improvements. Things that people could point to, things that would show that we've made progress towards ensuring that we have comprehensive access and other key areas in healthcare. And so with the first phase, which we launched, actually implemented back in February of 2008, was our Badger Care Plus All Kids initiative. It increased eligibility to all children in the state of Wisconsin, regardless of income, they don't have access to affordable employer-sponsored insurance. It also raised the income ceiling for pregnant women, as well as for parents. And so now we had a comprehensive approach to providing low-income families and even working families with access to affordable health care. Phase two which was a waiver that we got approved, which is to go after the core of who's left that was uninsured in Wisconsin and generally who's uninsured in America. And those are those low-income adults without dependent children, often called childless adults. That was the bulk of who was ineligible for care in Wisconsin and elsewhere across the country, and we got a waiver approved to do that. We implemented that program in January of 2009 with statewide expansion in July. Amazingly popular program. We received 72,000 applications for it in the 3 months that we were allowed to operate statewide. Unfortunately, we've had to cap that program because it functions under a strict budget neutrality cap, which has led us to phase three. When I said that initially we thought that by doing phase one and two, that would get us to 98% of our population having access. Phase three is our latest effort that's currently a bill working its way through the legislature would be to create a self-funded insurance product that would leverage off the Medicaid platform to help individuals who are currently on the wait list for the core plan, designed to be completely a temporary mechanism for those who otherwise would be eligible for the core plan. Together, our estimates are that these plans will serve 98% of the population. Here's our success to date. In terms of coverage for children and the other expansions that we did under phase one, 200,000 people have been newly enrolled, including 122,000 children. Phase two, as I said, 72,000 applications in 3 months. The program currently has 65,000 people employed or enrolled. And then phase three, we currently have about 23,000. Actually, this number's now up to closer to 25,000 people on the wait list for the core plan. That's who we're targeting with our basic plan proposal. All in all, right now, 20% of Wisconsin's population is receiving some kind of health care through the Medicaid program. That said, Wisconsin, like any other state, has seen difficult budgetary times. We, too, have seen our unemployment rate more than double from what it was before the recession. And so as a result of that, the Wisconsin Medicaid program has had to be part of the overall budget solution. In somewhat unique fashion, the legislature gave that responsibility for helping to find a significant Medicaid savings back to the administration and told us to go find $600 million worth of savings. And that basically forced us into coming up with an entire approach. Usually budgets, Medicaid budgets, and other things are department goes behind closed doors, works up a series of proposals, puts those in the governor's budget, the legislature debates them, and then we see where it stands when the governor gets the bill back. This time, they actually empowered us to make changes outside of the legislative process. We spent months engaging over 200 stakeholders from across the spectrum, providers, advocates, you name it. We had them at the table to come up with a comprehensive list of ideas. And that is what led to the Medicaid rate reform project, which I'll discuss in a moment. In addition, the R extension, extremely important, our level of funding, we're pushing for an extension of that. Our to date is already brought in $1.2 billion for Wisconsin. But we had a significant budgetary challenge, and we've continued to have the budgetary challenge as our caseload continues to rise with a downturn in the economy. The Medicaid reform project, as I said, was our effort to initially hit a legislative mandated target of $600+ million. We engaged these stakeholders and have come up with a plan that's actually on track to achieve our goal. There's 71 distinct items. It's probably one of the biggest administrative challenges that the organization I manage has had. It's a huge undertaking. But we actually think at the end of the day, it's been a positive undertaking for us. We've learned a lot from the dialogue. We put out a survey tool to over 30,000 individuals who have portal accounts with our program. We've gotten over 500 ideas from across the spectrum, not all of them great. but a lot of very interesting things, and which we feel has definitely, in fact, set us up for what we call Rate Reform 2.0, which is our second effort to look at this particular challenge. These are the guiding principles of the rate reform effort, both 1.0 and 2.0. And really what we've been trying to do is to avoid what other states have had to do, which is across-the-board rate reductions. To date, in Wisconsin, despite all the economic challenges, we have not cut rates to the vast majority of providers. We've made some tweaks, we've made some changes, but we, in essence, have been able to avoid it, and the big reason why is because of this comprehensive rate reform project. And also, what we've been trying to do is ensure access for members. Our view is that across-the-board rate cuts oftentimes come back to haunt you in one of two ways. Either people don't get access to the basic services they need and therefore end up in emergency rooms or in hospital stays, or else they end up in even more expensive environments because they go to the one place where they can get access, which are federal qualified health centers and others, where you as a Medicaid program are actually paying cost. And so we tried very hard to avoid creating access problems that haven't existed in Wisconsin in the past. This is just a list of a few ideas. I'm happy to answer questions about more things, but we've done a lot of outside procurement. We've tried to, and we're actually the first payer in Wisconsin to try to put a stake in the ground that we want to actually use data out of a comprehensive all-payer database on cost-effectiveness of providers to begin to adjust payments based on cost-effectiveness. We've done a lot in the area of drugs. Also, we found through our research that there's huge variations across the states in the percent of babies being delivered by C-section versus vaginal delivery, and we're actually changing our compensation schemes to incentivize more vaginal deliveries. Finally, our belief is that while we've made a lot of progress and we feel like we're really leading the country in a lot of ways in healthcare access, that budgets are really about priorities and they're about values. And when it comes down to it, when legislators and others have to take actions and governors take actions when it comes to budgets, their values and their priorities are reflected in those documents. Governor Doyle has been governor through two of the two worst budgets in state history, yet not once have we actually taken a step back in terms of access, and in fact, in each case, we've always taken steps forward. And we fundamentally believe that even in difficult times like today, creativity can lead to steps that will help those of us who are those of our fellow Americans who do not have access to health care and keep states moving forward towards real health care reform in America.
Terrific. Thank you, Jason. And finally, we're going to hear from Gwen O'Shea, who's the CEO of the Health and Welfare Council of Long Island in New York. That's the umbrella group for public and voluntary agencies that serve Long Island's poor and vulnerable. And access to health care is one of the four major areas of focus for that council. Gwen and her colleagues there are the ones in the trenches helping those who need coverage or care or other assistance to find it, and we've asked her to share with us today some of the on-the-ground experiences that the council's members have experienced in Long Island. Gwen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Ed, and thank you, Diane, for having me here today. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to sort of take a little bit of a different framework than those who spoke before me to really talk about what's going on the ground in terms of what are individuals, in particular low-income and middle-income working families, feeling as we look at the economic crisis and what that means to them in relation to health care. And to Jason's point, New York is in a good place in terms of some of the progression it's made in reframing its health care system. But we are certainly concerned, given the economic crisis, what that will mean to those changes and those progressions that we've made. And we certainly don't want to see the state take steps back and remove some of the ways that we've enhanced the delivery of care, really looking at a patient-first model. So I want to also just acknowledge some of my colleagues in the audience and the organizations they represent. You'll see yourselves referred to in my presentation, whether it's the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Families USA, Kaiser, of course, as well as Children's Defense Fund. So thank you for the work you do in helping us move our advocacy forward. So I just want to give you a little bit of an overview of where New York currently is. While we are the highest spender in terms of per capita in the nation, we still have a lot of work to do in providing care to all of our residents. 18% of New York adults are uninsured. 7.4% of children are uninsured, and we rarely achieve top health outcomes or statistics even though we have such a high expenditure rate. We have 2.5 million individuals who are uninsured, which represents approximately 14% of our population, and at some point throughout the year, we have over 5 million individuals who go without coverage. When we talk about who are the uninsured, as I said, that we have about over 2 million who are adults. Those who are poor represent a large portion of it, 49%, who are below 200% of the federal poverty level. Immigrants represent 30% of the adults who are uninsured, and the majority of folks who are uninsured reside in the downstate areas, so those within the five boroughs, Westchester, Nassau, and Suffolk counties on Long Island. One of the things I think that's important to point out, though, when you look at that number is folks who were arguing this sort of total number of uninsured throughout the country said that A majority of these adults are choosing to be uninsured on their own, voluntarily deciding they do not want to pay for health coverage. But over 50% of the adults who are uninsured are in the age category of 29 to 39, and they represent households where they are a caregiver or a parent for children. And we know that a children's health and success is directly correlated with the health and success of their parent. So many of the individuals that are in this category are individuals who simply cannot afford coverage. They fall outside of the catchment area for Medicaid or Family Health Plus, New York State's program. While we have a very lucrative Child Health Plus program, we do provide coverage to children up to 400% of the federal poverty level, regardless of your immigration status. So we're doing a good job covering kids, but the parents who are taking care of those children are unable to afford health insurance. They're not simply deciding that they don't want to purchase it. So what is the environment like right now on Long Island? I think it's important to point out, while we're not necessarily at the same percentages as Arizona, we are seeing that today, for example, 48 families will begin the foreclosure process. In the next hour, we'll have 6.4 private sector jobs that will disappear. And I think it's also important to look at what the GMP has been like on Long Island. There is a perception that Long Island is an area of affluence and of high wealth. But actually, it's been prior to the economic downturn that Long Island actually has been struggling with wages much more than those across the country. And if you see, in over the past decade alone, Long Island salaries have eroded by 7.5%. However, the cost of living has gone up dramatically. One of the universities released a research project just a month ago that pointed to the cost of living just in terms of basic necessities for a family of four on Long Island is $85,000. Another issue to take into account, which I know is probably the same in a lot of the other more older suburban areas across the country, is that there is a very small percentage of rental areas available to folks. Only 17% of real estate on Long Island is rental. So when you look at the high number of homes that are being foreclosed, many of those had been investment properties for individuals, so in low-income communities. So low-income families were renting these properties. When the market crashed, folks went into foreclosure, not letting folks know that the house was no longer available. And so now you have low-income individuals struggling to find some place to live when it's a difficulty, given it's only 17%. Just a couple more statistics in terms of the current environment. 21% of households on Long Island spend more than 50% of their incomes on housing. And these poverty statistics are based on 2002 to 2007, and we know we saw an even larger increase in 2008 and 2009. The food stamp utilization noted here, again, is from 2002 to 2007. In 2009, Long Island saw an increase roughly at 47%. I think it's also important to point out that the number one reason for folks that are struggling on and are in poverty, the number one bankruptcy reason for low-income to middle-income families in this country is related to health care costs. So a lot of folks that did not have coverage, similar to Jason's comment, that had some sort of chronic or emergency situation that forced them to get care are unable to pay for those costs and have now become bankrupt because of it. So why do we have so many folks that are uninsured? I think we could all respond to this question. Obviously, costs have gone up substantially. When you look at small businesses, one of the areas where we see the largest decrease in coverage from employer-based coverage, costs will go up roughly 23 to 28% this year. Job-based coverage obviously has gone down because of those costs. New York's unemployment rate has gone up roughly 10%, but the Medicaid numbers haven't gone up quite as much because folks are not eligible for that coverage. So you have this gap of individuals in a variety of communities, not just in New York, but across the country, that make too much money to qualify for public health insurance options, but do not make enough money because they're getting unemployment, it's their sole income, to pay for coverage for themselves or their families. So that pool of individuals that stay uninsured is continuing to grow. Of course, the other issue is navigating the public health insurance system. It's extremely difficult. As I noted in my earlier slide, you have 7% of children in New York State that are uninsured. Every child is guaranteed coverage in New York State. Even if you are above the 400% of the federal poverty level, you are able to buy in at full premium. But for many families who are unfamiliar with utilizing safety net programs, this is the first time they're tapping into these programs. They don't know how to access them. We also know that a large number of adults as well who are eligible for Medicaid, 37% of individuals who are uninsured adults are eligible for public health insurance. But again, there are barriers to accessing the program. We haven't made as many changes towards the simplification process as we would like, so folks are unable to tap into that benefit. Again, just to point to some of the changes in coverage that folks either purchase themselves or are provided by their employers, if you look at this percentage change, and this is national numbers on Long Island, the differentials are even more drastic. But if you see that in terms of family health insurance, there was an increase in the 7-year time frame of over 80%, and the increase in wages was only 11%. So for those folks that were contributing or small businesses that were purchasing, it becomes too difficult to continue that coverage. Again, New York, like the rest of the nation, is losing employer coverage. If you take a look at the number of folks who get insurance for themselves and those who purchase health insurance for their families, those numbers have dipped dramatically since 2002. And some folks do speak to the fact that the slight increase, the 27% in 2005 and 2006 to the 2008, 2009, tough to see with this background, I apologize, but that's because of the increase in public health insurance, that there has been a small increase in the number of folks that have been utilizing Medicaid and Family Health Plus. So what are the options when you talk about health insurance? Obviously, private out-of-pocket, which has become cost ineffective for a lot of folks. COBRA, while at the federal level, there has been an expansion made to provide some assistance to folks who are purchasing it. Again, when you look at the unemployment wages that folks would be bringing in comparison to what they have to pay, it's simply not doable. Public health insurance is an option for a lot of folks. Again, New York State covers adults up to 150% of the federal poverty level. So for the majority of adults, they are not eligible for any coverage. Again, they fall in that gap area where it's too expensive to purchase the COBRA coverage, and they do not make enough, or they make too much money to qualify for public health insurance. So what's the option? For a lot of folks, the option really becomes no health coverage. Our concern related to this, of course, is that there is no preventive care for individuals, and we've heard this over and over again. When individuals do not have preventive care, they're more likely to get sick, they're more likely to utilize the ER, they're more likely to not catch a condition that could have been caught earlier, and it becomes more costly to not only the individual but to the institution and to taxpayers. We also know that without coverage, especially when you're looking at children, there's a lack of productivity. Children without health coverage are 25% more likely to do poorly in school. They perform below the level of their counterparts. Another reason that we see from a lot of folks is the stigma related to public health insurance programs. So those who are actually eligible choose not to access benefits. You know, there's a lot of focus being put on Medicaid fraud and investigating folks that are incorrectly getting coverage. But the majority of folks that we deal with are on the other end of the spectrum and say, what can I do to make sure I don't qualify for Medicaid? I don't want to have to get Medicaid for my child. If I get a part-time job or claim I have a part-time job, can I apply for Child Health Plus instead? Or if a family realizes the adult is eligible for Medicaid themselves, they often won't complete the application because they don't like the stigma attached, so they choose to go without care rather than utilize a public benefit program. So just very quickly, obviously in New York State we're looking for state health care reform because it speaks to affordability for consumers and for patients. We're looking to also provide coverage, expanded coverage for individuals who are recently documented in the states, adults who are caring for their children who may be citizens of this country. And then, of course, you know, there are two pieces that we'd like to see, specifically, obviously, national health care reform while it's struggling right now to move through, we certainly would like to see it. For many of the reasons up here, it speaks to an individual's financial health. It talks about affordability. It obviously focuses on prevention and wellness. Overall, there's long-term savings for individuals and for states as a whole. And in the meantime, we certainly are pushing for the FMAP extension. This means states will be able to look at balancing their budgets a little bit more going forward, as Ed commented on. Federal government doesn't have to have a balanced budget, but states and counties do, and the FMAP money will allow that to happen while protecting programs and services. And I'm sorry I went over, so I'm going to pass it on.
Very good. Thanks very much. Gwen, now you get a chance to get into the conversation. There are microphones both at the front and at the rear of the chamber. Ask you if you use those microphones to identify yourself, keep your question as brief as you can and as specific as you can. Also, if you have questions, to write on a green card, if you will do that and hold it up, we'll bring them forward. And we'd be delighted to have that happen. Diane, I don't want to preclude you from doing it, but I would just start us off by asking any of our panelists. There's so much emphasis on the problems caused by the increases in cost. Is there any sense that outside of dealing with the costs of the healthcare programs that you run, that you can have some influence on the rest of the healthcare costs in your state, say along the lines that Massachusetts is proposing?
Sure, I can start. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we in Wisconsin, the Medicaid program is one of multiple payers as well as providers who are at the table around this issue about payment reform and purchasing for value. And one of the things we've done is to try to put a marker down, as I think we're the first payer to put a marker down, that we've been working hard to establish a statewide claims, a multi-payer, all-payer claims database, which would then potentially allow us to begin to calculate cost-effectiveness scores by provider, which would allow us to potentially adjust our rates to reward more cost-effective providers, to try to better align incentives in rewarding those providers. We're trying as a program not to get too far out ahead of that, but I think that there's definitely some opportunities and some synergies there. I think that's one of the areas, at least in my view, I don't think there's enough that are in the health care reform bills to date around those issues, but I think there's a lot of creative things happening at the state level.
Can I just ask whether you've had any success in getting Medicare interested in being part of that all-payer database?
Well, it's interesting is that I know up in the Northeast, I'm trying to remember whether or not this is the Vermont or whether it's Massachusetts, that they've got Medicare now to the table. And I know that the message we've been getting out of HHS is a higher degree of interest in potentially getting Medicare. To date, we have about 50% of all of the basically all the claims from 50% of the individuals in Wisconsin into the database, but Medicare is not yet in.
Tom?
The two things I'd mentioned from the state of Arizona include a similar type database that we work on with Arizona State University that's an all-payer database and looking at quality results. The second component with regards to Medicare is we have a number of our Medicaid plans that are also Medicare special need plans, and they're able to provide an integrated service delivery system to those dual-eligible members. So we've got over one-third of our dual-eligible members receiving their services through the same plan, which obviously results in better quality of care. And now we're just trying to find some money to get a study to go ahead and quantify those types of results that we've seen from our SNPs.
Thank you. Robin?
I just want to say quickly, since you asked that question, that the primary driver of Medicaid costs is really enrollment, and that's really been what's been pushing up Medicaid spending. And when you look at spending on a per-person basis, Medicaid does well compared to other other payers.
So. Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, Amy Morse from the Committee for Economic Development. I had a question for the panelists regarding the health exchanges. Both the House and Senate bills offer a kind of, you know, either national or state-based exchange, and I was wondering if you could comment on the possibility for a health exchange to reduce the cost of care and how that might impact your programs. And I was really happy to hear your comments from Wisconsin, because David Reamer actually recently authored a memo on building health exchanges and cited the Dane County model in Wisconsin, which saves about, I think, $3,000 per family plan compared to other regional exchanges in the state. So very innovative program. Just wanted to hear your thoughts. Thanks.
Sure, I can start there. Yes, David Reamer was very involved, former state official, in the development of within our employee trust fund, which is our state employees, the development of basically an Allen Hentoven-esque approach to trying to create managed competition pressures to control costs. Very successful to state employees. Governor Doyle proposed the development of a connector for our small business, small businesses in Wisconsin who, like small businesses all over the country, face very high costs and then also highly variable costs, you know, huge increases in costs from year to year of their commercial insurance, to create an exchange. Unfortunately, when the economy went south, we were not able to implement because we figured we needed subsidy dollars to help mitigate the effects of going to a modified community rating. But I can tell you that one of the things that we were most excited about the healthcare reform bills was the idea of a state-level exchange, because we definitely think that there's lessons to be learned both from the Wisconsin experience and then elsewhere, that harnessing the power of managed competition can lead to not only potentially lower rates or certainly mitigating growth in the future, but also a lot more transparency and potentially some opportunities for some other payment reform efforts through properly structured healthcare exchanges.
In Arizona, we had an exchange product for small businesses, for businesses up to 50 individuals, and it had some products that it would offer. But over time, it faced a lot of resistance from some of the larger commercial carriers, and we really never got to more of a collaborative arrangement with regards to that structure. So it has shrunk in terms of its size from over 20,000 membership and enrollment down to about 12,000 individuals currently, and some of that's obviously just as a result of the economy. But it does face challenges locally in terms of some of the political dynamics.
Very good. Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Abdullah Jones. I'm with the Men's Health Network. My question was, according to the 2009 Health and Human Services Poverty Guidelines, a person is considered to not be living in poverty if he or she earns $10,830 annually. That's just over $900 a month. And it's a fact that men are less likely than women to have health insurance. If men are forced to continue supporting their children despite their economic status, why can't they claim those children?
On that. I know in some states there has been a movement towards providing different tax credits to fathers. I know New York State in particular, the Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, has really put a full court press on engaging individuals, in particular those who are fathers, and working to change the way in which the tax credit is given. But in terms of the actual tax credits, I can't speak specifically to that. But there are some states that are, to your point, looking to restructure the way that tax credit is given for fathers who are providing child support.
Okay. Diane, you have some cards.
We do. We have one question related to the FMAP. Given the possible delays in federal decisions on fiscal relief, are states taking efforts to delay their own budget discussions or decisions, or to plan emergency sessions later? Or kind of what's the status of the states while the federal government hasn't moved?
Given it's an election year, I don't think that the legislature in the state of Arizona wants to delay their process too much, but what they may look at doing is either A, coming back and addressing it post-reaction of the federal government, or creating some sort of trigger mechanism in the ultimate legislation that would say if the stimulus is extended, then these are the actions that would happen and the cuts that would be restored.
Right. Actually, we're fortunate we're in a biennial budget process, so as a result, this is a non-budget year, so we do have a little bit more flexibility than the governors who are having, the legislators who are having to grapple with it at this moment.
Robin?
Many states have also included an assumption that the funds will be included in their budget proposals going forward, so to the extent that that doesn't happen, then they'll be forced to come back and relook at what will happen with that budget as well.
And in New York, although it is an election year, they are not anticipating a budget to, or folks are guessing that there would not be a budget signed until June, at which point we may know better about the FMAP, so it may be included then.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, Joan Alker with Georgetown Center for Children and Families. I had a question for Jason Helgerson about your, I think it was your phase three, the basic plan for the childless adults that you're not able to serve anymore because of the cap. Can you talk a little bit more about what kind of product you're offering them? And you said it was self-funded. So what is the cost? Is there any federal financing involved in that?
Sure. Yes, that is, I often get questions about that. What we're trying to do is to offer a limited benefit, which would mean, I'll give you some examples, 10 office visits in a year, one inpatient stay, 5 outpatient stays, generics only formulary with a couple of exceptions, things like insulin products for which there aren't a generic equivalent. So a very limited benefit. We're trying to keep the premium as low as we possibly can to try to minimize adverse selection. And so the premium we're looking at right now is $130. It would be a prepay. In essence, you'd pay for your health care for the next month, so kind of like private insurance. The goal is to have individuals in this program for only a relatively short period of time. We're hoping to be able to reopen enrollment for the program later this summer for the core plan, which is why we're creating BASIC, is because of the wait list for the core plan. And so our hope is that people will only be spending a matter of months on it. We've done some things designed to limit our exposure for even high-cost people. For instance, for individuals, after you've hit the inpatient and outpatient, there's a $7,500 deductible, after which we will pay. We are going to be paying our normal Medicaid rates. We won't pay outlier payments or some of the other things that lead to higher cost people. So we've done pretty much everything we think we can to try to avoid the adverse selection, including assuming we're adverse selected against pretty significantly. But it's going to be interesting because we've never actually run anything quite like this before.
I have some budget neutrality cap too, Jason, if you want to do a cap and trade program later.
Sure. I'm all I can use it.
This is a question more, again, for Jason, really to Wisconsin seems to insure people by increasing the public option of Medicaid and really building extensively on Medicaid, whereas the questioner says Massachusetts did more of the individual and small group markets through the exchange. And why did you choose one strategy, and what do you think the merits of that are over the Massachusetts approach?
Well, I actually think that Wisconsin and Massachusetts are actually quite similar when you actually get down to what it is that's happened in Massachusetts. I mean, they leveraged off their Medicaid health plans, much like we've done. We have probably done less. We've tried very hard to work premium assistance programs in. We've had a longstanding premium assistance program. It just hasn't proven all that cost-effective for us to try to buy people into commercial insurance. We just feel like we're able to serve a lot more people leveraging off the Medicaid platform. Understand that not in every state is that a reasonable expectation, in the sense that we feel like we've got a diverse set of providers. We don't have access issues that are comparable in some other states. So we felt like we felt quite comfortable expanding off of the Medicaid program. And we got a lot of stakeholder buy-in to it. But for us, at the end of the day, we felt it was the simplest, most cost-effective way to get at our ultimate goal, which was more people having coverage.
Let me ask a question that I jotted down as I was listening to the initial presentations. There was a lot of talk about access to health insurance and some mention of the role of community health centers. And I wonder if folks who are trying to find ways to get care to people are looking to CHCs, particularly since they seem to have found some favor among both parties here in Washington, as a way of alleviating some of the pressure on the programs to provide coverage.
In Arizona, the FQHCs are a critical provider and stakeholder in terms of our program. All of our health plans contract with the various FQHCs in their area, and they're a critical delivery mechanism of the services, not only primary care, but dental and other critical services for all of our Medicaid members.
Ed, to your point, I think that was one of the great things that the president included in his budget was the additional support for institutions or entities to open thoroughly qualified health centers, and actually Long Island is in the process of doing that right now, and we're extremely excited about what that will mean in terms of access to care and decreasing costs that other institutions who have become the safety net for the indigenous population will now be able to divert folks over to these centers where reimbursement will be that much better, and so will care.
Jason had a...
I would just say we wish we had more, but we actually, as far as if you do state comparisons, we have relatively small number of them in Wisconsin, but they obviously play a vital role.
Hi, I'm Merrill Guzner, and I'm an independent writer. We had two different approaches to dealing with rates. Arizona, you're cutting rates, and if I heard Wisconsin properly, you said you rejected that approach of cutting rates to providers, fearing that that would lead to people not taking up the program and then end up costing more later. So my question is, to what extent are rates, you know, in both states adequate, do you think, for providers? And what do you answer to the argument that is being made now by the insurance industry that this is contributing to the death spiral, in other words, these skyrocketing rates that, you know, there's fewer and fewer people paying adequate rates, whether it be in Medicaid or in the uninsured, and therefore leading to much higher rates in the individual small group and even large group markets?
In Arizona, we benchmark ourselves to Medicare, and at least on the physician fee schedule, we pay about 98% of the Medicare rate, and we pay higher for some specialties. So on average, when you compare ourselves, we're a top five payer for state Medicaid programs, and access to care obviously is a very important issue to us. We do some studies with regards to hospital reimbursement, and we find that we're in the low 90s with regards to percent of costs covered, which is a lot better than zero for some of the population, which wouldn't receive any compensation if they weren't for Medicaid. So we believe that we had some ability to play with some of the rate structures. We talked to providers going into the budget crisis, and we've kept the lines of communication open. And to a large extent, their understanding of where we're at with regards to our program in Arizona. And we haven't faced the lawsuits like California has and some of the other states have that have pursued rate reductions. So it was, you know, one of the things that we felt we could do and still be able to ensure access to care for our members.
In Wisconsin, we're comparable to Medicare, very much almost identical to Medicare on the hospital side. But in terms of physician rates, I wish we had the circumstance that you have in Arizona with rates comparable to Medicare. And I think that one of the advantages, we have not had that much complaining from the insurance industry in Wisconsin about our expansions. And because I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that our largest insurance companies also are participants in the Medicaid program. So as a result, they stand to benefit. In fact, if you look at, we're a heavy managed care state, I mean, just on the commercial side. And while commercial managed care has declined overall in the commercial world, as more and more businesses have self-insured and they're not buying the HMO product, a lot of that drop-off in utilization has been more than made up for on Medicaid, as Medicaid has grown and we've moved more and more of our members into managed care. So I think it's somewhat created a somewhat different dynamic, and that they're now, those commercial HMOs now getting over $1 billion of capitation payments on an annual basis, and those are the same commercial HMOs that are serving our commercial population.
In terms of some of the strategies that you all have looked at for trying to save some dollars and limit some of the Medicaid spending, this question relates to the use of Medicaid estate recovery and asking whether you've seen more aggressive efforts to recover funds via the Medicaid estate recovery route. Is this one of the places states are turning?
We're doing more with Medicaid estate recovery, but in terms of the housing values in Arizona for those types of liens, obviously you have less resources to be able to go after. But in terms of the overall program, it's $9.5 billion, and our recoveries tend to amount less than $20 million. So, I mean, you're talking about just dealing with very small increments on the edge.
I would agree, but I do think that we are trying to be very aggressive. I would actually say that where we're being more aggressive is in terms of third-party collections in general.
Right.
We have quite a few people who may have coverage or had coverage at one time on, in the commercial world, trying to make sure that Medicaid is always the last payer. And also some issues around that with Medicare, particularly for dual eligibles, and we think that there's some greater opportunities there, but none of these projects are going to be the ones that will balance the budget, but alone. But that's, in essence, our approach has been not, there's no one single silver bullet to these things. That's why our plan to save $600 million is 71 distinct items. All those items together add up to $600 million, but any one individual item doesn't get you there.
Yeah, Jason makes a good point. In terms of overall, you have to look at program integrity, and it's much broader than just specific items, and it includes coordination of benefits. And we saw a 25% increase in our coordination of benefits, largely because I think you've got people transitioning out of coverage else places and coming into Medicaid.
This is a question for you, Tom. Can you talk about the difference in the House and Senate bills in terms of covering the newly eligible? Have you seen the White House proposal on the language, and what do you think?
No, I have not seen it. It was the first question I asked to those that had seen it was, how do they define newly eligible, because it impacts Arizona significantly. With regards to the House bill, because they define newly eligible as the childless adults, it actually results in savings to the state of Arizona and those few other states that have already expanded, versus the Senate bill. Because Arizona has already expanded, there's a $15 billion difference over 7 years just for the state of Arizona in terms of how we get treated versus how all the other states get treated because they have not previously expanded. So that's why we have a lot of concerns with regards to the whole issue of newly eligible and the fact that it should include the childless adults.
And just to be clear on our facts, both bills in general say that if you're newly eligible, the feds will pick up
right, you get that higher
100%
match,
of exactly. The match for a given period of time, whereas
exactly.
If it's somebody who's not newly eligible but comes on, you get the same match as you had now.
Right.
And the president's proposal seems to be a blend between the House and the Senate of opening up the definition of newly eligible, but not specific enough to answer the question definitively.
Yes. With some match, but not quite the same match that other states would get, right?
Right. Now, this one I think is one that we want to hear the answer to be yes, but the question is, are states taking the opportunity to put in place long-term cost-effective solutions like preventive care, chronic disease management during this time of fiscal crisis so that during the next cyclical economic downturn, they'll be able to be less reactionary and more prepared to deal with increasing health care needs?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that if I were to show you the list of the 71 ideas, there are a number of them that show no savings in this biennium. The reason we're still doing them is because we feel like they're in the long-term best interest of the program, acknowledge that in some cases these things take time to get off the ground, and now is the time to do it. If we just focus on our immediate challenge and not deal with the fact that eventually our level of funding will go away, that we're going to, who knows how long, I hear sometimes projections that it could take 10 years before the labor market recovers to the period or the point we were at before this massive economic downturn. Hopefully not 10 years, but I think that it behooves all states to really think long and hard about what they can do in their programs to really bend the cost curve.
There's no doubt that states are having to be reactionary to this recession, but I don't think anybody would have counted on a 35% decrease in your revenues at the same point in time you're seeing 25% increases in your caseloads for Medicaid. So, you know, you can only do so much planning for those types of economic difficulties. We in Arizona have mature Medicaid managed care plans that we believe do a good job. So part of what we're just trying to get through this time is preserving our core infrastructure in terms of the great provider network that we have, preserving our core infrastructure in terms of the competitive health plans that we have. So that's really our goal as a management team during these difficult times, and then doing some of the long-range planning with regards to how are we going to institute more of a medical home model and those types of things with some of our FQHC partners.
Rob?
I would just say that rings true when we do our national surveys across all the states, that states are really still focusing on doing more of managed care, disease management, care coordination for high-cost individuals, really focusing on quality in hopes that, again, in the long term, that generates some savings. And more states are turning to HIT and using more health information technology to hopefully, again, in the longer term, generate some type of savings.
But the problem is many of the states are facing having to make savings that are immediate,
right.
And those are usually not the long-term investments.
Right. But Robin brings up a good point. The HIT money is a significant investment by the federal government that states have to make sure that we do our best in managing the Medicaid incentive payments and getting providers involved in that program to understand the opportunities that exist there.
Do we? I'm sorry, go ahead.
And one of the questions that arises, too, is in terms of looking at the changes that you're going through, many of us have been focused because of health reform on more of the acute care side of Medicaid, but what are some of the changes being envisioned, this questioner wants to know, on the long-term care and long-term services side?
Sure. I mean, I think that's the – sometimes we, when the economic downturn, we're very focused on the growth in enrollment, which is driven – that's on the low-income family side. But what's the longer term, talk about longer term trend, is the baby boom generation entering into a period of their lives where the likelihood of them needing long-term care services is going to increase. And you know, that's the big long-term challenge that Medicaid programs face. In Wisconsin, what we're aggressively trying to do is to move more and more of that long-term care population into our managed long-term care program called Family Care, which we hope to have within the next couple of years statewide. Completion, statewide expansion completed. Our belief is that they're applying managed care principles in a long-term care setting while at the same time ending the, we think, this skewed element of long-term care, which is if you need long-term care services, you can get it, but only in the nursing home, and ending that practice and allowing people to get those services in a community-based setting is the direction. But that said, I was saying to folks earlier that this is it's a huge undertaking with a whole different set of characters and stakeholders. Trying to impose managed care principles in that environment is a challenging process.
We've got over 70% of our membership in home and community-based services that are in the long-term care program. It's all fully managed care organizations that run it, and we do a good job of continuing to move that number north. We don't know when. We keep thinking, well, 60% was it, and then we hit 60%, and we thought 65% would be the max. So we continue to have a lot of success in moving our members and receiving their services in the home and in the community versus institutions. So.
And is it the case in both of your states that long-term care constitutes, or rather services to the aged and disabled, constitute a majority of the spending in the Medicaid program?
It is the majority of the spending. Just for example, those individuals that are in our long-term care plan, it's 4% of the individuals. It's 27% of the costs. Now break that number out, you know, to a larger group of aged and blind. Yes?
Long-term care is about 50% of the Medicaid budget. Wisconsin.
In New York State, it's even higher.
Okay. This question is for you, Jason. Wisconsin has always been a leader in things like welfare reform, and now is at the forefront, obviously, of state reforms. How does that translate, or what lessons could you offer from Badger Care for the national health reform efforts?
It's funny, I'm not getting asked this question. The governor often gets asked this question, and he's always very careful not to try to tell folks in Washington how to do their jobs because they understand the dynamics on the ground here far better than we do. I guess, you know, our approach, the governor's approach, has been more of an incremental one. But at the same time, we feel like those incremental steps, which if you look at it over a 4-year period of time from the first proposal to where we sit today, has increased enrollment in our program by 275,000 people. We're almost to universal access to coverage. We made those steps, you know, in difficult political environments. My boss is the governor of Wisconsin, a Democrat. When he first got elected, legislature was controlled by Republicans. You know, so we had to navigate difficult landmines. We had to build constituencies and build relationships across diverse sets of stakeholders. We had to get Republicans to vote for these things, along with Democrats. And so I think if there's anything lessons learned is that we spent a lot of time and effort trying to build these relationships to make the case across the state as to why these things were important. And, you know, in terms of that, that's certainly progressive incrementalism has been our approach. But I think that at the end of the day, after a 4-year period of time, we feel like we've made a lot of progress.
We don't want to impose on people's times. Let me just offer each of our panelists the opportunity to make a final comment. And while they are thinking about whether to avail themselves of that opportunity, I ask you to pull out those blue evaluation forms and fill them out. I believe we've exhausted the wisdom or perhaps only the endurance of our panelists. I want to thank you for being part of this conversation at a time of great uncertainty. in the debate over health reform. What we do know for certain is that the problems that we've heard, both fiscal and clinical, are going to persist at both the national and at the state level, and we're going to need enlightened folks like the folks on this panel to keep working at them with the support of your bosses and the folks around the country. So thank you for being part of this. Thanks to the Kaiser Commission and the Foundation for playing such a big part in helping put this program together, and ask you to join me in thanking our panelists for this great discussion.